Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This episode of The Murder of My Family is brought to you by Madison Reed. Madison Reed has hair color that is gorgeous, salon quality, multidimensional, ammonia-free, and delivered to your door, all for under $25. Visit madison-reed.com for 10% off, plus free shipping on your first hair color kit with promo code FAMILY. That's promo code FAMILY.
If you would like to discuss the murder in your family on this podcast, please be sure to visit TheMurderInMyFamily.com for more information. You can support this podcast by visiting Patreon.com/TheMurderInMyFamily. This episode may contain unsettling material or subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
Thank you for joining me for this episode of The Murder of My Family. Please allow me a moment to share some important information before we get started. If you find that you enjoy this podcast, please take a moment to rate and review it wherever you listen to podcasts so that the show can continue to grow and reach new listeners. To learn more about the show or the cases we discuss, please visit themurderandmyfamily.com. You can also find us on Twitter with the handle @murderandmyfam. Or by searching for the Murder My Family podcast on Facebook. If you'd like to support the show via Patreon donation, it's always appreciated, and you can do so by visiting patreon.com/themurderofmyfamily. If you prefer to, you can also support the show through a PayPal donation by visiting paypal.me/themurderofmyfamily. In each episode, I give shoutouts to any new supporters. In this episode, I'd like to thank Daniela and my friends Jen and Lindsay at the Corpus Delicti podcast. And thank you to all of the supporters that generously donate and keep the podcast going and improving. One last item. I'd like to invite you to check out and subscribe to my YouTube channel, in which I talk about all kinds of true crime topics and projects that I'm working on. Just go to YouTube and search for True Crime Guy, and you'll find my channel. I plan to create new and fresh videos for the channel, as well as have interactive chats from time to time. So I hope you'll consider checking it out. Thank you, and now on with the show. Losing a sibling to a senseless murder would be hard for anyone, and we've discussed several cases involving the murders of siblings on this podcast. But imagine if that sibling is your identical twin sister, your best friend, someone that was literally part of you. In 1996, Jody LeCornu was murdered in Baltimore, Maryland, in a shocking and very public act of violence. Jody's senseless murder was devastating for her sister Jenny, who's been searching for the truth ever since. Almost 23 years later, both Jenny and police still don't have answers. In the early morning hours of March 2, 1996, 23-year-old Joanne LeCornu, or Jody as she was known to family and friends, walked out of the Mount Washington Tavern in Baltimore, Maryland after last call. The Towson College student had spent the night drinking after a bad argument with her boyfriend hours before. One of the bar employees asked Jody for a ride home. Although it was beginning to snow, Jody, who wasn't fond of driving her Honda Civic in bad weather, agreed to take the employee to his home in the Roland Park section of Baltimore. After dropping off the bar employee, Jody stopped at a liquor store and purchased a six-pack of beer, Likely not wanting to return home to another argument, Jody instead decided to drive to a parking lot in the back of what is now known as the Drumcastle Shopping Center, located at 6401 York Road in the Towson section of Baltimore, just around the corner from Jody's home, and about 3 miles away from the Mount Washington Tavern, where she had spent time earlier. Jody pulled into the parking lot sometime around 3 a.m. She sat in her car intending to drink her beer, likely wrestling with a lot of mixed emotions and personal demons. Jody had a long history of alcohol and drug abuse, dating back to her childhood. Despite overcoming drug use, Jody was still wrestling with alcohol abuse, and things like an argument with her boyfriend might have sent her to search for a drink. Jody's need to go off and have a private drink in a secluded spot in the early morning hours of that March day must have been quite strong, because Jody was uneasy about the city of Baltimore after dark. The high rate of violent crime left Jody uneasy and untrusting of strangers. Jody usually tried to avoid putting herself in situations that might expose her to danger. It wasn't like her to sit in a deserted Baltimore parking lot, all alone in the dark. As Jody sat drinking her beer, she made a couple calls from her cell phone. One was to the Mount Washington Tavern. The other call was to the boyfriend of a woman that lived with Jody and Jody's boyfriend. It's not known why Jody made these calls or what she said, but she did reach her roommate's boyfriend, and they talked for a few minutes. While Jody sat parked in the deserted and lonely parking lot, a car pulled into the lot, its headlights shining on Jody's car. The new arrival to the parking lot, a white BMW, pulled close to Jody's Honda. It's anybody's guess what, if any, kind of conversation Jody had with the driver of the BMW, or if she knew him at all. And it's also not clear how long the two drivers were there in the parking lot together. What is clear is that at 3:40 a.m., workers inside a giant supermarket, as well as a person delivering supplies to a Boston market, both across the street from where Jody was parked, heard a gunshot. When they looked out into the darkness to see what was going on, they saw Jody's white Civic drive across the street and into the giant parking lot, where it coasted to a stop. It was followed closely by a white BMW. The eyewitnesses watched as a man got out of the BMW and walked up to Jody's car and reached in. It seemed as if he had put the car in the park. He then appeared to grab something out of the Civic before walking away and getting back into the BMW. The white car pulled out of the parking lot, heading south on York Road, and turned east onto Walker Avenue, before vanishing from sight. The eyewitnesses immediately called police, and the call was received at 3:41 a.m. Police arrived on the scene moments later, but it was too late. Jody LaCourneau was dead behind the wheel of her car. Investigators determined that her killer had shot her once through the rear window of her Civic. The bullet, shot from a .38 caliber handgun, passed through the seat and into Jody's back. She somehow managed to drive her car across the street trying to flee, before passing out in the giant parking lot where the car came to rest. Police questioned the eyewitnesses, who described the shooter as being black, in his mid-20s or early 30s, between 5'10 and 6'1, and weighing between 200 and 220 pounds. He was wearing a fatigued military-style jacket, but none of the witnesses was able to get the license plate number of his car. Detectives had the difficult task of notifying Jody's family to break the news to them. It would prove to be especially difficult for her parents, who were to celebrate their 34th wedding anniversary that day. Instead of a joyous anniversary, they had to face the shocking truth that one of their daughters was dead. Across the country in California, Jody's twin sister Jenny got the news that Jody was dead, and she felt helpless being so far away. She hastily made arrangements to get back to Baltimore. On March 6th, 4 days after Jody was murdered, a service was held for her in the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland. Meanwhile, police continued their investigation into the murder, questioning several people, including those closest to Jody, and those with more casual connections to her. They started exploring various theories and motives for the murder. Police looked into the possibility that the murder was a result of a drug deal gone bad, but found no evidence of that. Jody also had no drugs in her system at the time of her death. Police also explored the theory that Jody was simply the victim of a robbery gone wrong. It was discovered that her purse and her cell phone were missing from her car. Jody's father was an assistant state's attorney in Anne Arundel County and had prosecuted many drug and violent crime cases. So police even looked into the possibility that Jody's murder was revenge against her father. But there was no evidence pointing to that either. Months went by with no arrest. Almost 6 months after the murder, in August of 1996, Jody's parents were still grief-stricken and trying to figure out how to cope with Jody's unsolved murder. They placed a memorial in an Annapolis newspaper to try and express what they were feeling in words. The memorial read, "Several months have passed since we lost our 23-year-old daughter, Joanne Elizabeth Jody. When she was on the threshold of college graduation and marriage to her fiancé of 5 years, her promising life was cut short by an unspeakably savage act. On March 2nd, in Towson, she was shot in the back from the rear of her car while seated at the wheel, alone and defenseless. The assailant, still unidentified, then took her purse and car phone and fled into the night. It is our earnest hope that this odious creature eventually will be apprehended and removed from society. In the meantime, we are coping with Jody's tragic death the best we can. We miss her terribly. The bullet that ripped through her tore pieces of our heart away. Although not fatal, our wounds can never fully heal. The scars, sorrow, and pain will remain. Jody was a sunbeam in our lives, and in those of others as well. She still lives in our fondest memories, forever in our hearts, forever smiling, forever young. To be sure, we have been sustained and comforted beyond words by the thoughtful expressions of sympathy and concern received from so many friends and professional associates in the Annapolis community. This outpouring of support, which continues to this day, has included substantial contributions to the reward fund being administered by Metro Crime Stoppers of Baltimore. Donations have come from people we don't know, and some have been anonymous. To all of you who have reached out to us during this extremely difficult time, we express our heartfelt and enduring gratitude. Jody thanks you too. The family of Jody Cornu, Annapolis. Months with no answers in Jody's murder turned into years, and years into decades. Jody's father passed away, never knowing who murdered his daughter. Along the way, police revealed that in addition to having eyewitness descriptions of the killer and his car, they also had surveillance video of the killer and fingerprints. But all of that still hasn't led to an arrest. Jody's twin sister, Jenny, has made it her personal mission to keep Jody's case alive and to keep searching for the person that broke that special bond that she had with Jody and can never replace. Jenny has been interviewed for several news segments about Jody's murder and appeared on television shows including True Crime Daily. Just recently, only days ago in fact, Jenny helped erect a new billboard asking for tips about the case and offering a reward of $32,000. The billboard went up only a day after what would have been Jody's 45th birthday, very close to the spot where she was murdered 22 years ago. Despite frustration and a lack of an arrest in this case, Jenny isn't planning to stop looking for the truth in her sister's murder. She joins me to talk about Jody's case and her efforts to get justice after this message from our sponsor. Today's episode of The Murder of My Family is sponsored by Madison Reed. For decades, women have had only two options when it came to coloring their hair: outdated at-home hair color or the time and expense of a salon. The future of at-home hair color is here with Madison Reed. Gorgeous, salon-quality hair color delivered to your door on your schedule, all for under $25. Madison Reed is reinventing hair color with the convenience and affordability of at-home hair color and an ammonia-free formula made with ingredients that you can feel good about. And Madison Reed is Leaping Bunny certified, which is just one more reason to feel great about trying Madison Reed. One box contains everything you need to color with confidence, including barrier cream, a protective cap, two pairs of gloves, and a cleansing wipe. And a cream-based formula means no drips, no mess, just gorgeous color with 100% gray coverage. Find your perfect shade at madison-reed.com. And Madison Reed would like to honor listeners of The Murder of My Family with 10% off plus free shipping on their first color kit with the promo code FAMILY at checkout. That's promo code FAMILY. Join the hundreds of thousands of women who have tried and love Madison Reed. Visit madison-reed.com.
In Puerto Rico, we call ourselves Boricua. We are proud, passionate, and full of life. On our island, adventure finds you. Strangers aren't strangers for long. The size of the audience doesn't change the beauty of the music. And we celebrate every last ray of sun. Live Boricua.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey everyone, it's Billy Morrison and Ozzy Osbourne here. Our new show, The Madhouse Chronicles, is dropping this April. Join us as we watch and react to the maddest internet clips. What do we discuss, Ozzy?
Drugs, rock and roll, aliens, all that kinds of shit.
Drugs, rock and roll, aliens, and all that kinds of shit. Visit osbournemediahouse.com for early access. What do you say? Do you think it's the wildest show on the internet?
Oh,
you're in the madhouse now.
And now back to the show. Hi, Jenny, and thanks for coming on to discuss Judy's case with us today.
Hi. How are you, Mike?
I'm good. I appreciate you coming on and doing this. And the first thing I wanted to address with you is that you and Jody were twin sisters. It's clear that any person who loses a sibling would have a lot to deal with. It seems like for a twin who loses their brother or sister, it might even be more devastating because typically twins are so close to each other and have that special bond. Was that true of you and Jody?
Yeah, absolutely. We were 2 minutes apart and were inseparable. We spent our whole growing up together, just, you know, we always had the same room and a lot of the times in the same classes and same friends. You know, we spent our pretty much every waking moment together and the same, like I said, slept in the same, you know, we were in the same room. And we were definitely very close, like having your best friend around,
telling each other secrets and things that only the two of you, you know, kept between you and stuff like that.
Yes. Yeah. We're always together, always had her around. And I mean, as we got older, we looked a lot alike when we were younger, but as we got older, we, you know, people could start to tell us apart. We were identical, 2 minutes apart.
And tell us a little bit about Jody's background and what kind of person she was and what kind of memories you have of her.
So Jody was just a very sweet person. Very, you know, had a big heart. She, my friends like to say she was the life of the party. She was very, outgoing. And I was more the shy one. And, you know, she was, I'd say, more the stronger. I was referred to as Jenny the Wimp for some reason. But she was the stronger one. And, you know, when I'm thinking about, like, our high school years, she was definitely more, like, did her hair up like perfectly and the right, she had to have like the right pink lipstick. And I mean, she just really was like the more glamorous one, you know, just, she was very striking. And she also struggled quite a bit, you know, both of us starting young with eating disorders and alcohol and drugs. And she is a good soul, but definitely struggled a lot. Her life
as twins, that was something, the good stuff you had together, that was something bad that you shared with between you.
Yes, absolutely.
Take us back to March of 1996 when Jody was killed. How did you find out about her death?
So we actually ended up through a series of events being separated, and I had moved out. My parents had taken me out west. And so Jody was in Baltimore and was living with her boyfriend at the time. And I ended up getting engaged. I actually, after a period of time living on a dude ranch where my parents had placed me, I moved to California where I got engaged. And, so I found out, you know, we, even though we were separate coast to coast, we still talked on the phone every day, and I would come home and visit. I remember that Saturday morning trying to call her and she didn't answer the phone. And I got this weird feeling, but it wasn't anything like this horrible feeling, but just a weird feeling. So it was shortly after that my fiance came flying into the door and said, "Jody's dead." And I just immediately, I mean, just went numb in shock. And I didn't know how to, you just don't know how to handle something like that. You know what I mean? It's like, from that moment on, I was just in, like, I say almost like a robot, like just going through like the motions. And I mean, everything was like so much of a blur. We immediately got on the plane, you know, as soon as we could, got to the airport and came back to Maryland. And that's when I started to find out more of the details of what happened. And it was just so shocking because it's just something like that is something you'd see on TV or a movie, and just for something that your twin sister was murdered. And it just, I mean, like I said, it was years of just being in shock and not being able to cope, you know. And I couldn't even be by myself in a room for years. I mean, it was really bad. I ended up coming home and living with my parents, and I was just absolutely terrified, not, you know, from losing her, and then the manner of which, how she was shot. And it just, you know, and I still over the years suffer from tremendous anxiety and get, I mean, I used to wake up, she died, it was, I believe it was 3:41. And I mean, over time, through the years, I'd wake up like around that time, you know, in the middle of the night, just freaked out. And so, yeah, it's something that never, I mean, and even as I got older and had kids, like I was afraid to, you know, my husband, if he had to go out of town, I'd lock my kids and I in the bedroom at night. I was so terrified, like somebody was coming after me. So yeah, I have like horrible anxiety.
It scarred you in a way that mm-hmm. would be, it's not like she died in a car accident or from illness or something. It's the way she was taken.
Right, right. And I mean, unfortunately, she and I we had anxiety when we were young. So, but it's, I just know that losing her has, I mean, it's, like I said, it's called, like, I guess enhanced, you know, the anxiety and bouts of depression and the years of trying to find out what happened. And my father got sick with cancer and you know, he was a prosecutor for drug and violent crime. We were, you know, it was just very heartbreaking to go through taking care of, seeing him very sick and him not being able to see justice for Jody, you know. And after he died, I really was like just really focusing on her case. And honestly, for a long time, I didn't know that there was really anything that I could do with her case. But I just started to just talk to people and just really try to get her story out there, because I was really frustrated with the killer still being out there and just wanting answers. And so I've really spent a lot of time over the years, including the lawsuit with the police, with the Baltimore police in Baltimore County, trying to get her file, and doing podcasts and just doing whatever I can on the social media. I mean, it's ripped up my family a lot, unfortunately, like my husband and I. I mean, we've had horrible problems. I mean, he's supportive, but it has really just come between he and I, and me being a mother. I have three kids, and it's been over 20 years, but like this last anniversary, I sunk into like a really huge depression, and I honestly didn't know that I was going to come out of it. It was really bad. The anniversary being March 2nd, which was actually my parents' wedding anniversary. I'm just very grateful. I have lots of the friends and my family and lots of the news and reporters and, you know, people that have reached out to me on social media that have really, I'm getting emotional now. That have helped me, because I get really down and hopeless and just like really frustrated with this and angry, you know, all sorts of emotions. But like I said, you know, like the stress on the family, and I mean, that's just been huge as well. And you know, I still suffer from the anxiety, and that's debilitating. I mean, it keeps me from doing a lot of things.
And that's the snowball effect that I see with a lot of people I talk to, is that when somebody's taken away, when they're murdered, it affects other people and ruins parts of their lives for the rest of their lives. And that's the unfortunate thing, is because when one dies, other people are victims too, in a different sense.
Oh yeah. And then even with my father, you know, my father was the greatest person on the planet. I mean, he was such a good man, and he struggled with addiction as well. And this just, he spiraled, you know, after losing Jody, he spiraled downward, and just, it was so awful. And with my parents, and I spent even like a lot of years trying to like, I was like trying to make everybody happy and feel good because I was so worried about everybody else that I feel like I wasn't like taking care of myself, or, you know, trying to really, grieve or what, you know what I mean? Cause I don't feel like I've fully really, I mean, I honestly feel like a big part of it hit me this year. I mean, I feel like I'm really good at like moving, going, like just because I can't sit still. I can't think about things. It's just really easy for me to run. And, it's really hard to be with just me. I also struggle with my own personal battles as well, you know, but it's just, it's really hard. And, I also want to mention, I'm very fortunate. I mean, I know that I have a wonderful life. It's just really hard living with this. And it's like this big open wound, and I get so hopeful. Like, we just recently did this billboard on York Road. We put up a billboard last Monday where it says "Find My Killer," and it has Metro Crime Stoppers number, and we have the reward $32,000. So I get really up when I'm doing things like this. And I did some interviews. I did an interview with CNN and a bunch of Baltimore, you know, the news stations. And I feel really positive and hopeful when I feel like I'm getting her story out there. And then I would lay in bed at night and think, oh my gosh, what if nothing happens? What if not, you know, it's like my mind starts to mess with me. And so I got to constantly like try to stay positive and just, you know, to really hope that we're gonna get answers.
It sounds like it's a bit of an albatross around your neck, weighing on you constantly.
Yeah, you know, and even as far, you know, like I said with my husband, like it's like I said, he's supportive, but even like, and it's like it's really hard for him to see me spending a lot of time like doing podcasts and doing stuff, because he feels like he's like, Jody's like, you know, we got into a huge, I had Good Morning America come to my house the other night to do an interview, and I don't know when that's going to air, but no, and it, oh, they came, they were there for hours, you know, it's like a big ordeal, it's a school night, and yeah, but I would do anything to get her story out there, but it caused pretty much World War III. So, you know, it just was a reminder of being at the house and doing the interview and him listening to the interview, and just that, because there was like a period when I was going through this whole lawsuit, going back and forth to Baltimore, and just very stressful meeting with like the police lawyers and the financial part of it. I mean, we spent $20,000. No, that was, you know, my mother was, I mean, we all like put that together, but it was just like a lot of strain on the marriage. And so it's been really hard for me to sort of find that balance of trying to, if that's the right word, trying to be active and do as much as I can. I mean, my mind is constantly going like, what can I do? What can I do? Who can I call? Who can I reach out to? And then being there, like present with my family and the kids, and, you know, and then I have the anxiety piece of it where I woke up this morning and I was from horrible anxiety, and I feel like I'm jumping out of my skin, and I want to jump off the roof. Like, it's so bad sometimes. And then I will, like, I'm a nice, calm, kind person, but like my kids push me and I like just snap this morning. And then I feel like this horrible person. So it's like a vicious cycle.
It's all weighing on you and affecting other parts of your life, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think I told you I got involved with, and I would recommend this to anybody, with hospice and doing a lot of volunteer work with them. And it's just, that's been like a really, really good, I say like a healing, just, it's just been an amazing experience for me, because I always feel better when I'm helping people. So I like to help people. So that's been really like a really good thing. But I honestly, I feel like just a mess. Yeah. I feel like it's like day to day, you know.
In Puerto Rico, we call ourselves Boricua. We're proud, passionate, and full of life. On our island, adventure finds you. Strangers aren't strangers for long. The size of the audience doesn't change the beauty of the music. And we celebrate every last ray of sun. Live Boricua.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey everyone, it's Billy Morrison and Ozzy Osbourne here. Our new show, The Madhouse Chronicles, is dropping this April. Join us as we watch and react to the maddest internet clips. What do we discuss, Ozzy?
Drugs, rock and roll, aliens, all that kind of shit.
Drugs, rock and roll, aliens, and all that kinds of shit. Visit osbournemediahouse.com for early access. What do you say? Do you think it's the wildest show on the internet?
Oh.
You're in the madhouse now.
Let me ask you this. At the beginning, when this first happened and you went back to Baltimore to be with your parents, what did the police tell you at the time that they thought happened? What was their theory? Did they think it was something random? Did they give you your family information and keep you guys aware of what they were doing?
You know, I honestly think back then they were saying that maybe it was a robbery. With my dad being a prosecutor, I think we were lucky. He was in another county, but, you know, he said he prosecuted drug and violent crime, that we were lucky that I think, how to better say this, maybe because he was not one of them, but, you know, sort of part of the, maybe they sort of stayed contact with him maybe a little bit more, but I was just not even anywhere. I mean, I literally was just not even involved in like that aspect of it. Like I was just trying to get through each day, and I was like engaged at the time, and I that like broke off, like, you know, talking about like relationships and like I said, I couldn't even be by myself. Like I was just, I honestly don't even remember like a lot of those days. I mean, this is embarrassing, but you know, like my parents had their own bedrooms, which, and I had to sleep with my mother. I was never by myself. I was like that, like traumatized. And, I mean, for the longest time. So it wasn't, so we, and my dad pretty much had like the highest respect for the police and everybody. So he absolutely just felt like that they were doing everything they could. And, I think he just sort of, he wouldn't be one to, be hounding them. You know, he was a very, which is hard to believe because I was always the shy wimp one, but I just got like this backbone, and I was like, I'm done. And, I'm trying to be patient. And, I just feel like there's a lot to her case, you know, with the description of the suspect and the vehicle and the fingerprints. And I just feel like there, I don't know. It's just mind boggling to me. And I, not that I'm trying to put anybody down or anything, but this just seems sort of like a case that, in my opinion, not just because, I mean, yeah, because it's my twin, that should have been solved. I mean, it just, you know, I mean, after all these years and learning stuff and talking to people, and it's really hard, you know, and I, you know, as time goes on, it's like all these years, you know, it gets, I mean, definitely I get hopeful when you hear of like a case after 20 something years being resolved, but you know, I don't know. And then people are constantly sending me stuff about this, like genealogy. I don't even understand it, like genealogy stuff, because what I'm told, there was no DNA.
And that's what's frustrating in this case is it lacks maybe some of the evidence that other crimes that are being solved do have. Her circumstances of her murder are kind of odd. You know her better than anybody else would have known her. Was she the kind of person that would go sit in the a dark parking lot by herself at 3 a.m. in the morning?
No, not at all. I mean, she was terrified of everything. And I mean, even though she drank and she struggled with the drinking and she was trying to, and she would put together times of being sober. You know, that was alcohol was her drug of choice. And she sort of drank to, which is not the answer to her habit of drinking to like calm her nerves. But the alcohol just makes everything worse, you know? And like I said, she had tried to get sober and terribly, and it was just heartbreaking to see. And unfortunately she could hold a lot of, you know, she could drink a lot. So she, when she was drinking, it was like she was drinking on a daily basis. So it was, I mean, just for this night, I mean, for her to just go, I mean, her boyfriend told her not to come home, but just for her to go sit there, for her to be driving late at night. And they, you know, they'd asked her to drive this employee home who couldn't drive. And she, I mean, as like she would help anybody, but it, late at night, there's some reason why she did that. I don't know why she did that. She wouldn't have driven in the snow. I mean, she just, and she would tell us, she told my family, she was afraid she was going to get shot in Baltimore, right, you know, right where she was. I mean, and she was 2 minutes from her house. So, that's not in the county. I mean, she died on the, it was like this county city line. So if you can say this, like it wasn't a bad area, stuff like that didn't happen there. It was.
And so in your opinion, even if she was drinking, you don't think she would have let down her guard and went there to sit there in the dark? That just wasn't like her to do something like that.
No. I mean, I'm thinking, why didn't she just go if she truly didn't think she, first of all, I don't know why she did. I mean, she had friends, like why she didn't make a plan to go stay with somebody. But why wouldn't she have gone to sit in front of her house or something? You know, and if her boyfriend didn't want her to come home, why go sit in a parking lot? I don't know. Yeah, I mean, then I go back, I'm like, well, maybe she felt comfortable because she was close to her house to sit there. But I don't see her doing any of that.
Yeah. And I think that's what's so frustrating in this case is it's, it seems like on one hand, she's not the kind of person that would go out there and sit there in that position where somebody could come along and do that. But then that happens and you start to wonder, ask yourself questions. Is it random? Did somebody plan on meeting her there? And then you're left with all these questions and no answers.
Right. And then I go back to the thing about like her work. Then I think I never thought about this, like her job, because I didn't know much about this place. She was at this bank. I'm like, was there something going on her work that I didn't know about? You know, she had been over, I don't know how many months, she had been in two different detoxes. Did she meet somebody? Like, I mean, I for sure there was people that I didn't know, maybe that she knew. Do you see what I'm saying? Like,
just that endless questions. It sounds
right,
like
right.
Endless possibilities. And that's, for me, when I hear about these kinds of cases, that's what's frustrating, is that there's no clear picture. So I can only imagine for you, wrestling with all these different theories and ideas and possibilities can only be really tough.
Yeah, it's like you start to go down one. I mean, like I said, they started off early on, you know, with my dad because he prosecuted drug and violent crime. Did it have something to do with that? And they quickly ruled that out. You know, was it a drug theory? Was it a random, you know, just a random crime? Now, just the way that it happened was so bizarre. And, you know, like we talked about earlier, him shooting her, following her with people around. I mean, and then her window was rolled down, you know, the phone calls. So there's just so many different scenarios and you start to go down it. And you know, I mean, I go through it in my head all the time. And like I said, I'm constantly, my next thing is, I mean, I'm honestly, when I told you my mind's constantly going, I'm like, I think I'm going to have to become a police officer or a private investigator. Because I'm like, I mean, that's just how I go through my head. Like, I've got to, I'm constantly trying to figure out how I can solve her case.
Well, all these years later, you're still working hard on it. I know you've been on different TV shows and podcasts and done interviews, and it seems like you're doing everything you can for your sister. So I think she'd be very proud of you and happy that you've done this. I know you took you mentioned suing the police department to try and get access to her files. So you've gone above and beyond what most people could do or, you know, would do. So I think she'd definitely be happy about that.
Well, I appreciate that. I mean, it's just, it's very hard.
Yeah, and I can, you know, I know your father passed away, but I can imagine it's still tough on your mom as well, having to, all these years, still not have answers either.
Right. Oh, yes. I mean, she's been through so much, Roland.
Well, I hope that your family does get the answers that you've been waiting for so long. And do you have any websites or Facebook pages or anything where people can go check out or learn more about her case or provide information if they have it?
So, yeah, well, there is, so we have this, I mean, there's a Justice for Jody, I don't know, it's a website that actually have a friend of mine that's put together that's amazing, that's actually on the billboard, so it's just Justice and then the number 4, Jody. We have the Justice for Jody page on Facebook. You know, I put stuff on Twitter and then my own Facebook page. I mean, and any other suggestions of ways that I could get her, you know, information out there at Carreri, Carreri _. Is that right? The little Jenny, JNNY. I'm on Twitter, but I don't know much about it. I mean, I had a reporter put me on and he's like, start putting stuff out there. Be interesting. Do this, do that. So it's career. It says the word carrier with an I, and then, yeah, I'm not very like savvy on all this stuff, but, I try.
Yeah, definitely a good way to spread the word, you know,
a bit
more and have people learn more about it. And is there a phone number where people can call if they have information, like a police tip line or anything like that?
Oh yeah. So there's the Metro Crime Stoppers. Okay. There's a $32,000 reward. And it was the Caldor parking lot where she was shot. That was it's now government buildings, but on York Road, but it's Metro Crime Stoppers of Maryland, 18667 Lockup. But you know, the billboard, and that's like about a mile down the road, from where she was shot. That was about the closest we could get it. And I'm open if anybody has any ideas or anything, you know, you or any, you know, to keep her, you know, keep her story out there.
And the right person just has to see it and come forward, hopefully, and maybe that gives you the answers that your family has been waiting for so long.
Oh, definitely.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Murder of My Family. As we wrap up this episode, I'd like to play previews for two true crime podcasts that I think you'll enjoy. The first is for the Murderous Minors podcast, and the second is for Good Nightmare. And before you go, remember that every murder victim means something to somebody.
The simple truth is that children kill. Kids have murdered their best friends, teachers, grandmas, and even their own babies. Children have killed alone and in groups, with other kids and sometimes with adults too. Who can even begin to speculate as to how people can justify resorting to murder? Not us. This show focuses on the facts, details, and circumstances which give rise to murderous minors, killer kids.
Hey everyone, this is Sarah from Good Nightmare Podcast, a podcast where I like to talk about all things strange and unusual, whether it's mysteries, historical crimes, or fairy tale origins. I hope you'll come along for the ride and join me as we delve into some spooky tales. Happy listening!